Okay.
I made some reference certainly earlier in the earlier recording to the mixed feelings when I was a student at Manchester University about the need for social work, for people to go on social work training. This, of course, was pretty characteristic, I imagine, of the whole scene at that time, although I didn't know it, because we were only just moving out of the period when the social science courses and the few degree courses that existed had been seen as being the social work, the training for social workers, and were teaching about biology and economics and law in the social science courses were seen as essentially part of what was needed to become a social worker, and any notions of casework, whatever that was, and psychology and in a kind of technical applied sense, were not really seen as very necessary. The child care courses started, and it's, I think, always to the credit of government that they actually once, I think it's probably only once, promoted a training for a new service before the service actually came into existence. These courses had been initiated by the Home Office and were, I think, regarded by most of the universities as courses which they were being paid to undertake by the Home Office and were no part integral to the university teaching and way of life, and were really kind of agency bits of activity funded by Home Office money. The fact that the courses were relatively new, that they were short, and that the service was new, I think led a number of people to believe that that it was quite unnecessary to undertake a further training after you'd become a graduate to work in the childcare field. And that the courses were pretty trivial and pretty preoccupied with childcare legislation and with the technical activities of boarding out and so on, and these things could be learned perfectly well on the job. I think this completely ignored the reality of the experience of many people who went into the childcare field, where whatever the limitations of the work that could be done, they frequently face, particularly in the bigger cities, caseloads of anything from 100 to 150, and certainly a number of childcare officers I knew, or boarding out officers I knew in the early 50s, had caseloads of something around 100, 120, of whom 40 or 50 might be adolescents who were bursting out all over, as it were. The childcare officers of that time were in fact working very long hours, with impossible situations, trying to be sensitive to the expectations of the new children's departments, aware of the public interest in those departments being effective, and also dealing with residual problems of children who had been in the old style children's homes for many years, and who hit all the problems of the effects of institutionalizing when they were thrown out into hospitals or into domestic jobs or onto the labour market. So that if the childcare training courses did nothing else but to enable young graduates to dwell on some of the kind of situations they would be faced with and arm them with some knowledge and skills that would equip them more clearly for the job than they would previously have done with a purely theoretical teaching in a degree course, the courses, and as well as giving them a chance to mature, they would have, I think, been they were valuing themselves. But I think that's a great misreading of the childcare courses, and it would, for example, be a great misreading of the major contribution that Claire Winnicott, or Claire Britton as she was then, made to the development of the childcare training at LSE. I think it was certainly the case that some of the childcare courses were in fact not very good, and that others were very much better, or very good, but that to throw young graduates into children's departments in the circumstances of the early 50s was, I think, totally unfair, and really showed, in the case of some of the university teachers I knew at that time, a lack of understanding of what it was really like to be cast in that role. Said with feeling.
I'm not really permitted to quote my wife, who does not like being quoted in this context, but who I might say still suffers from the consequences of that.
My wife was in a similar position in the early 60s in the LPC. She got out of the
Oh, it was terrible.
Yeah, it was terrible. It was still 4 or 5 years. And if she must have been somewhere else, it's the same. You know, I mean, the first was in Bethnal Green. And it...
Oh, sorry, the thing's going off. Yes. Go on. I didn't... I mean, I made some reference also to being in Oxford House, I think, when I was doing the mental health course. Important bit of influence, important bit of experience, which I suppose influenced me a lot in subsequent work, was really working and living in the settlement in Manchester when I was a student for about two of the 3 years I was in Manchester, and in which I was in there when the settlement reopened for the first time after World War II. And shared the experience with 3 or 4 other people, all of whom I still know, of living in a flat in a new housing area near the settlement, and having the temerity to teach some of the local mothers how to make jam, having never made jam in my life before, and our having gained the reputation when we initially moved into the flat, since one of the people in the flat was a very beautiful Indian girl in a very delightful series of saris. We gained the reputation that we were a group of film stars, apparently, who had were going to make a film in the street. God knows what the poor people of Ancoats thought we were up to, but we got on quite well with the people we met, and I think we thought we were doing something which would now be called community work. Certainly, I've always been grateful for the experience of reading stories to children, which I've subsequently used. As I say, I still subsequently use my experience of making jam. I certainly scrubbed out a good many problem families' flats in the process. We also had an aftercare scheme for people leaving school. This was arranged with the Youth Employment Service, and I remember having to visit regularly 4 or 5 adolescents, 3 of whom were girls, and whose fathers looked at me extremely suspiciously when I arrived at the doorstep, on the doorstep, as a relatively young student, saying that I'd come to visit their daughter to ask how they were getting on at work. As a father myself now, I'm not sure that I would have let them in. It says something, I think, for the over-visiting of people in Ancoats that they in fact let us in. And I never really did understand what I was supposed to be doing. But I met quite a number of very nice girls. Well, LSE and the Applied Social Studies course. Well, I've dwelled at some length already about the fact that I don't know, and never have done, what a generic social worker is. I have some idea of what generic teaching is about social work, although I don't like the use of the term generic now because it's so misleading. Certainly, in the time that I was at LSE, my whole memory of LSE is greatly influenced by the tensions and discomfort of the arguments which went on at the school about the development of the new Applied Social Studies course and the effect it had on both the staff of the department and the relationship between that new course and the mental health course and the child care course. Many of the people involved are still alive, and I don't feel free to say all the things that I might say about my perception as a relatively junior member of the group about the ways in which people behaved and the what the arguments were all about. But I think what I can say is that there always seemed to me to have been two sets of arguments, and that understandably, publicly, it looked like one set of arguments, whereas privately, there was a different set of arguments. The public set of arguments seemed to be about the relationship between a more general approach to social work, education and practice, and a more specialised one. And that was symbolised in the relationship between the new applied social studies course, which was an attempt to be, quote, generic, unquote, and the mental health course and the child care courses as so-called specialist courses. The private argument was much more about the relationships between staff and the status of staff and their relative position within the department. My own view is that many of the problems that arose in the relationship between those two courses was arose because of mismanagement of the whole situation at a departmental level, too many attempts by some of the senior people involved to be popular with everybody. Satisfy everybody when in fact not everybody could possibly be satisfied when their interests were in conflict. But of course, as a relatively new psychiatric social worker, I had a personal identity with that field and a sense of defensiveness about anything which took away from me, as well as from others, the newly gained specialist knowledge that I had so recently and to some extent painfully acquired. And I'm sure the reaction of a lot of people in the specialist fields of social work was a personal one as well as a more objective one. But the issues, the objective issues, were, I think, very real ones. It was perhaps an oddity of the position of the two courses I came to know best, the Applied Social Studies course and the Mental Health course, that the Mental Health course, having existed at the school since 1930, was somehow or other well accepted in the school. Of course there were people who were critical of it and thought it was really rather odd phenomenon on the face of the London School of Economics, but yet somehow its association with mental health and psychiatric and this and that somehow gave it a kind of air of respectability, which of course wholly described as being in social work, somehow didn't have. And certainly the Applied Social Studies course, quite unjustifiably, suffered from a degree of criticism within the school simply because of this. And it was equally the case that there was a degree of support for the mental health course among staff of the school, which was not very rational and quite the explanations and motives for which it would be very difficult to understand. There were a number of things that it concerned me about the development of the Applied Social Studies course and the whole movement that it symbolised. First of all, it seemed to me there was a very real danger that social work was in fact going to become some kind of technical training with too heavy a preoccupation with with the technical aspects of practicing. For example, I remember having lengthy debates and shocks of horror at hearing terms like, quote, knowledge for use, unquote, discussions about the need to teach skills. Now, I wouldn't feel anywhere near so shocked about either, and people hear me now talking about skills much more than I did then, and I think I was being over academic as a relatively new university teacher. But at the same time, there did seem to me a very real danger, and there still seems to me a very real, there was a very real risk that the development of the applied social studies course movement might tend to put an overemphasis on sets of tricks and insufficient emphasis on the development of people's attitudes and capacities to respond flexibly to a variety of human situations and to use their imagination and capacity in a knowledgeable but also skilled way without in fact feeling that they had to go through a number of rather ritualistic routines. Now, to put it like that is really unfair on those who were enthusiastic about the applied social studies movement, but I think that what we did see was not so much at LSE but at elsewhere a tendency both in some of the courses in Britain and also in the United States, a degree of preoccupation with the techniques of social work which overwhelmed the teaching on which that needed to be on which those skills need to be an outcome rather than the basis of them. Yes, that one very well put. Well, I suppose that in order to that the movement behind the applied social studies courses was one which was based on identifying those common elements in the practice of social work which applied to all the fields of within which social work was practiced in the United Kingdom or in the United States. That's a perfectly reasonable thing for a group of people to be doing, whether practitioners or teachers, in fact a necessary and responsible thing for them to be doing to identify those things. What I think tended to happen was that the general elements tended to be around the skills and methods of social work, and that in the process of doing that those skills and methods came to dominate the planning of curricula, so that curricula tended to be related to the need to support the development of that teaching. I just don't believe that in fact you can so closely associate the range of academic disciplines that need to be taught to social workers so closely with the technical aspects of the application of social work. I think I'll have to think about that and elaborate that a bit more when I've seen it on paper. I always had and remain having very considerable doubts about whether the generic movement in the United Kingdom was going to be a help or a hindrance. My current feelings are that it has turned out to be a hindrance, although I can well see the need for reorganisation of services, we'll say, in the way in which CBOM recommended. I can certainly remember in the 50s having many arguments with people advocating the development of a local authority family service, and Arne Younghusband was one, since it seemed to me that there were positive disadvantages in facing the consumers with a monopoly in welfare. And I've always believed that in pluralism and in therefore in the division of power, and that that it's the basic democratic right of the citizen to be able to play off services if they allow themselves to be played off. And there are more dangers in the rationale for bringing everything together on the basis that it will be more efficient and more effective if it's all brought together, because this tends to reduce the consumer to a powerless kind of position. Now, personally, I came to support the CBOM developments, but as a transitory development. And if you look back at the comments and evidence that the Council for Training and Social Work gave to the CBOM committee, I remember it being prefaced by some comment that what we were saying we did not envisage as a blueprint, but as something which might be useful for the next 20 years. So that's still my view. I don't personally see the social service departments in local authorities as a permanent feature on the British landscape. I don't think that we can forever go on without closer administrative connections between the personal social services and the health services and the education services. I regret the fact that CBOM was implemented at a time when local government was preoccupied with its own managerial and organisational problems, because it seems to me to have created a social service department system which looks new but in fact is very old-fashioned in its managerial structure, and which has not yet come to terms with the fact that it has a large number of highly educated personnel at the bottom of the pyramid in its hierarchical structure. Local government has not been able to come to terms with that more generally. It's come to terms with it in the school system, but that's because the schools have their own, as it were, autonomous units of operation. But if one looks across other areas of local government, housing for example, then housing departments, it seems to me, like social service departments, have not yet been able to come to terms with the fact that the local housing But at any rate, the local housing personnel who are responsible for units of public housing are now often graduates, but are caught in situations of powerlessness and bureaucratic entanglement in ways very similar to many of the social workers in area teams of social service departments. I know I shan't be very popular for saying this, but I'm getting to the stage and age when I feel I can afford to be chopped, but it does seem to me that the future of social work in this country cannot possibly lie in the present structure of social service departments, and that unless in fact something pretty radical is done about the structure of those departments, social work will ultimately either die or come out of them and develop in different ways probably in the voluntary and private sectors. There are already signs of this, I think, and I would expect them to develop and flourish. So I suppose looking back on the last 20 years in this respect, I would blame myself as much as many others to having contributed to a process which has been, I think, a large scale one in the United Kingdom, of seeing value in larger scale systems, in larger scale organizations, in more effectiveness in bigger organization. And I think all of us have now learned, not only in the public services but also in industry and commerce, that large scale organizations have very great disadvantages, and that the degree of depersonalization, the degree of time spent in communication, the amount of time spent in actually keeping the organizations ticking, is such that you may in fact divert into all of that degrees of talent and capacity which ought to be making direct provision for the clientele, whether they are in the in industrial processes or the consumers of public services. So for my money, if I was starting my career again now, one of my first preoccupations would be how to set about breaking up the systems that we've now got into smaller units and smaller autonomous units. And as far as social work is concerned, particularly seeing the development of much smaller autonomous, semi-autonomous neighbourhood units, where social workers carry a degree of legal responsibility for their actions in which they are answerable to the courts. I have no great faith in statutory registration as a way of protecting the public, but I do have some faith in the courts as a method of protecting the public. I don't know that's much to do with generic training, but still. And I don't know that I'll let you publish that bit, but still. Not quite that way, but still. I'll see. Well, the class structure of social work, I mean, I suppose that I was one of the generation of post-war university students from relatively modest backgrounds who came into the university system in large numbers and brought into the university system people who were first generation undergraduates and from families who had no experience of higher education, and that I, like many of my colleagues, I think, had to find ways of coping with a situation in which our families and our parents' perception of the world was a much more, or what seemed to us to be a much more limited one, a much less well-informed and educated one than we ourselves were getting. We varied in the degree of arrogance or non-arrogance with which we imposed our new ideas on our families and our parents. And I didn't really get very far with my extended family, who really, on the whole, assumed that I was some jumped-up character who'd gone out of the West Country to go and study, and that when I came to my senses I would soon be back in Devon. And there are certainly some of my aged relatives who still think after 35 years in London that I'm up here for a short visit and will be returning soon when I've recovered from a minor aberration. So some of them, I think, didn't let me get away with any degree of arrogance on the part of my newly found education. For people like me from our kind of background, I was very conscious of the fact that, for example, many of the psychiatric social workers that I first met came from a financial and class background very different from my own, whose confidence and poise and perception of the world was a very different one from mine. I suppose going back again to what I said earlier about the LSE, one of the most searing experiences, I suppose, one of the most valuable experiences I gained from the tensions at LSE was to discover that if in fact you were born into the right social class and the right social background, you could have in fact access to a variety of people in powerful positions simply because of your social network, and that this had nothing to do with your professional position. This certainly was one of the problems that posed considerable political difficulties for the LSE. It was also the case that I soon came to learn that it was possible to offer one's resignation from a job on a point of principle if one had a private income, but rather more difficult to do if one had a wife and family. And so some of the conflicts between the social backgrounds from which I came and the social backgrounds from which some of my new colleagues came was soon very evident. The way in which I got into the local authority scene, and particularly the mental welfare officer scene, soon made me realise that here were a whole different group of people whose background and life experience was very different from many of the social workers, particularly the older social workers that I knew. I must say here that in saying all this, I'm in no way critical of a lot of those social workers. I think they had a sense of what I can only call kind of noblesse oblige, for which I have a very great respect. Not many of the ones that I knew in psychiatric social work could in any way be called patronising. They had a kind of sense of responsibility and involvement and engagement in the social services, which I suppose might have come originally from some degree of sense of superiority or of certainty in relation to other groups in the community. But if they had, I think they had come to examine those motives and to come to terms with them, and that I have the very greatest respect for the ways in which they had managed to extricate themselves from their own social backgrounds to come to a degree of equity in their relationships with their clients for which, as I say, I have the greatest respect. But in social situations, there was no doubt that many of them were poles away from the average mental welfare officer or the average welfare officer in a local authority department. And not least, of course, because many of the psychiatric social workers were women, and most of the mental welfare officers and welfare officers were men. But it certainly one of the things that attracted me about the development of the non-graduate courses recommended by the Young Husband Working Party was that this would pick up on the interests that I had when I was an undergraduate student in adult education, and in the development of courses within the further education field, about which I knew relatively little, but which about which I kept up some connections throughout the period when I was at LSE by a lot of extramural teaching in places like Southend and Guildford and all over the Greater London area, I think, in extramural department courses with a whole variety of people, from customs officers to school teachers to bus conductors. And it was that part of it which I think attracted me, with the strong belief that I had in that at that time, and which I now don't wholly retain, that education was the means by which people could obtain more power over their lives, would come to a better understanding, would reduce conflicts, would reduce the potentiality for wars, and that education therefore was an end to be pursued, and something into which resources should be poured. I think I, like many others, have now come to realise that one may in fact enable people to certainly exert more power over their lives through being able to understand the processes that affect them better, and certainly I wouldn't want to advocate people remaining in the situation like many of my family were, in which they had a kind of fatalistic belief that what went on in London or what went on in heaven or what went on in Bristol somehow had its end results in Devon and there wasn't anything much you could do about it. at the same time, I think we now understand a bit better that education may only make social problems more sophisticated ones, and that they don't in fact solve conflicts or solve social problems, but like a better housing, there's no reason why people shouldn't have social problems in good housing conditions and express their problems in more well-educated forms, and have better capacities for overcoming them through having better incomes, better housing, and better intellectual capacity to tackle them. That sounds all very good. I suppose that I believed, and I suppose still do, that because of the difficulty of breaking across the barriers of one's own social background and the social background of one's clients or one's students, the greater the variety of people in social work with a variety of social backgrounds, the more this would contribute not only to the quality of the services given to the clients, but also would contribute to social workers being able to share with each other the impact of their own life experiences on the ways in which they work, and to not make so many assumptions about the ways in which people live, influenced by their own prejudices and assumptions, which however much one may try to examine them and put and allow for them and perhaps even put them aside, are bound to influence one's perception of the outside world in ways that one doesn't even realize. Certainly it seems to me that the infusion in social work of large numbers of people from a wider social background have in fact greatly benefited social work, though I think it has also been done at some costs. One of the costs, I think, is that some of the people who've come in to social work from a social background with less confidence and less, therefore, a less sense of inner certainty about what they're about, have, I suspect, been less willing to stand up and be counted in the face of some of the conflicts that exist between the needs of clients, the needs of social work, and the needs of the organisations in which now social workers are employed. And that may be unfair, but I suspect that it's the case. What I hope is one of the things that may have been achieved is that social workers coming from a wider social background, that we've perhaps overcome in local government some of the problems that, for my money, the relieving officers symbolised, and that was the people who moved into positions of relatively minor power, or the petty bureaucracies of local government in the earlier part of the 20th century, who then tended to turn in a critical and sometimes punitive way on the people who remained within the social groups from which they had originally come. Now, it does seem to, I've heard this said, for example, about some black social workers in the United States, that they, as a result of their movement into more powerful positions, have in fact become more damning of their black colleagues than white social workers, we'll say. It certainly seemed to me that some of the problems that we had with the old poor law system could be accounted for by that movement of people into minor powerful positions. I trust that the better education and the thinking that social work education provides for people moving into more powerful positions has in fact offset that possible consequence of the widening of the social background of social work staff. I'm pretty sure I'm not going to let you publish that. I was called a fascist for trying to say that, and the evidence to see that.
It's well within most people's experience.
Yes, quite, yes.
I remember when I worked in Islington, the housing manager there, when you phoned up to tell him a sad story about a family, regularly told you that his mum brought up 9 children.
Yes, quite, they yes.
managed them.
Yeah. Yes. Well, you asked me about when I was teaching on the mental health course, I think, and the point that Kay McDougall made about the preoccupation of students about the controlled use of relationship. I don't know quite. I've never quite thought of it in these terms, I suppose, for a long time. But I suppose that that you have to set it in the context of the time when. First of all, a large number of the older students coming onto the mental health course came from what they called social work jobs and now wish to move into psychiatric social work. And I think the best parallel I can draw now would be to say that I think that some of those students thought of social work as perhaps now people might talk in a slightly derogatory way about welfare, that it was kind of welfare out there that was involved with giving people money or doing things for people, and that in a kind of direct way, and that what they now wanted to move into was something much more sophisticated. Now, that much more sophisticated thing was indeed in the context of all the discussions derivative from psychoanalysis and so on about relationships. But I think it would also only be fair to say that a lot of the people who came, say, from the Family Welfare Association or from the Child Care Services or from the care committees, or some from health visiting, as well as people from social workers and trainees in the mental health services, through their experience in providing direct services, had in fact come to think, whether rightly or wrongly, that some of those direct services were, it wasn't that they weren't important, but that they didn't in fact solve anything. And that therefore they were looking for ways in which people could be helped to tackle more basic problems that seemed to create the situations in which they were frequently in need. Now, it's no doubt that that on the whole, people, in many cases, thought of those as being problems which were within the person or the family. Though I think it would be quite unfair, really, to say of social workers in that generation that they didn't realise that a lot of the problems that people were faced with were, in fact, the creation of economic conditions or the employment conditions or the work situation in which people, or the housing situation in which people were. And it, I mean, they weren't daft. And I mean, they could probably well see that people were living in impossible housing conditions or that they hadn't got enough money to live on. And they weren't suggesting that those housing conditions or the limited income were in fact the quote fault of the family or the client. But I think, I mean, there may have been some people who thought that, but on the whole, most of them didn't think that. What I think that many of them did believe, and I think they were right to this extent, it didn't, that even if the income was better, or the housing conditions were better, or the employment circumstances were better, that this wouldn't resolve in themselves, we'll say acute marital problems or acute psychiatric conditions or severe problems arising from depression and unhappiness that led people to become addicted to alcohol or because they persisted in petty theft or in shoplifting or what have you, or were just constantly bickering and miserable.